Because it would be good to do that. Hello, we are live. It's midday. And yes, we are doing it later at 7 p.m. So if you have tuned in and thought, I really like my Sunday evenings in the UK listening to these two fellas, well, we're still doing that as well. And we're just waiting for Mr. Anthony Chafee to arrive. But of course, let's introduce Richard Smith, in case you don't know Richard. Richard, do you want to say hello?
Hello. Nobody knows who I am.
Oh, they do. You've now got 6,500 subscribers, I think. And I did an interview the other day and mentioned you. And there's ever such a lot of people in the comments saying, I've not heard of him, but I'm going to go and find his channel now. So you should have a little extra bump there. And of course, they're going to know you at the Easter weekend, aren't they? Because both you and I are going to be at the War on Health.
Spot on, yeah. War on Health, the end of this month, 30th and 31st of March. Two-day event. Some fantastic speakers lined up. Super excited. I still haven't written my presentation yet, but...
Oh, dear, Richard.
But I know what I'll be talking about. It's just I find that having visual aids helps explain things. So... the talk is down to a T, hopefully within my head, but it, I just need to put it onto those slides to present.
Yeah,
and you've got you've got a fantastic talk lined up as well.
Yes, well, I've been a goody two shoes and a little girly swat, and I've done my presentation, sent it off to Phil and the War on Health men, and. Yeah, I think it's going to be good. I'm going to be talking about blood. That's my presentation. It's going to be talking about the context of blood and how it's different when you're a carnivore, when you're low carb, when you're keto, and how you can interpret them differently. And I mean, that's backed up. That's my book there, which is doing very well, Guide to Blood Tests in that context. So, I mean, that's... one of the things I'm looking forward to is actually getting up and seeing some people face-to-face rather than being online. And then they can see, this isn't a filter. I've just got two white lights and a blue light behind me. And some people seem to think that I don't want to be out in the real world. But I'd much prefer that. But we can reach, 1,000 people this way, can't we? Rather than however many, 700 people at the conference. And of course, we've got a lot of people tuning in because they would like to see Dr. Anthony Chafee.
He's just messaged to say he is now logging in. So keep your eyes.
He's here.
Oh, there we are.
I was going to say, he's backstage. So let's bring him on, shall we? Should we bring him on? Yeah, why not?
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
How are you doing, man?
Sorry, guys. Hey. Hey. How are you both doing?
Yes, really well. You?
Yeah, good.
Good, good.
There's no light there. Yeah, good.
So it's 8 p.m. with you, I think.
Mm.
Yeah,
it is.
So another late one. So well appreciated. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. I know we've... a little bit awkward with you with the time difference, but great to see you.
Oh, good, man. Yeah, good to see you guys.
Yeah, looking forward. Before we kick off, Steve, shall we jump on to what we were just speaking about in regards to events? So Dr. Chafee's coming to the UK. For the PHC event. So do you want to talk a little bit about that, Anthony, and then we'll go from there?
So the PHC conference is in London this year, and that is, what weekend is that? It's May, like the 18th and 19th, that weekend, like 17th, 18th, and 19th. So that's a big, that's the biggest annual conference that the Public Health Collaboration have. This will be a ton of speakers, some people from the US and from Europe and Australia coming over to speak at that. So the Public Health Collaboration is, they're really just trying to be both a grassroots movement to get people healthier and get the information and, just the best information that they can so that people can fix their health and fix the healthcare system from the inside out, get other doctors on board so that they can see what they, different sorts of tools that they can use to get their patients healthy and to try to affect political change as well, although that's always difficult with all the special interests and money involved in politics. But, you know, you can get people interested in these sorts of things when you get enough grassroots support. So that's sort of the idea there. And yeah, so it'd be my first one. I tried to go last year, but then I had some visa issues and I was grounded in Australia. So this year it's not a problem and I'll be able to come. So it'll be great.
Fantastic. Looking forward.
Excellent.
Looking forward.
Yeah. We've got tons of questions, of course, and a few people have asked the question, can I ask questions? So yes. Because it's a live question and answer thing. It's not a live answer. So, fire away your questions. If you could keep them to carnivore, that would be really handy as well, or keto or low carb, because there are some odd questions, but I'll throw them at you, Anthony, anyway, because why not? You know, it's Sunday. So I have the first question. You ready for this, Dr. Chavey?
Sounds good.
Okay, right. Hi, guys. I'm a long-term Crohn's sufferer with an ileostomy, After watching you and others, I've started to think I could be cured on carnivore. What's your views on this being possible? My doctor says no.
Yes. Most of the teaching would be that they would say that, and that's perfectly understandable that he's coming from that point of view. But no, that's absolutely possible. You need to be very, very strict. You need to be on just red meat and water only. This is something that people have been using since the 1800s. There have been gastroenterologists in the 1970s named Dr. Walter Vogtland. Don't know if that's pronouncing it right, but that's how I'm guessing with the weird spelling. And he wrote a book called The Stone Age Diet, where he talked about how humans are carnivores. Here's the evidence for that. And all these diseases that we're treating now are basically a product of eating the wrong thing. And, he, as a gastroenterologist, was pointing out that there's different diseases that he treated. Basically, if you didn't eat plants, you wouldn't need him as a specialty, as a profession. But there are controlled trials and interventional trials in humans showing that Crohn's disease in particular is very affected by diet, massively affected by diet. There are two studies in particular that I think are very interesting. One was an interventional trial with what's called an elemental diet, and this person might be knowledgeable of this, maybe it's something that he's tried before. It was something developed for ketogenic kids, kids with epilepsy, so they were generally ketogenic, but they're just the elements, right? So the base macronutrients and micronutrients that you need to survive, and nothing else, and it's generally ketogenic. So you just take this shake. It's very processed, but it's it's just the macros and micros and nothing else. And they found that was a better treatment for Crohn's disease, for an acute flare-up of Crohn's disease, than prednisone, so steroids, prednisolone in the UK and Australia. So just not eating certain things was a better treatment than steroids, which is the gold standard for getting someone out of a bad flare-up. So obviously diet has a lot to do with this. Changing something that you eat seems to have a cause and effect relationship. You remove something, problem goes away. You return that something, problem comes back directly. That's a cause and effect relationship. There was another study that just removed carbohydrates and fiber and saw how long, tried to see how long people would go into stay in remission without medications. And some of the participants stayed in remission without medications up to 51 months, which is over 4 years. So that's quite a long time in full remission with just dietary changes. And contrast that with those who did not come out of come off carbs and fiber. They stayed in remission on average 0 months. Right, so there's a big contrast there. So yes, of course, diet has everything to do with this disease, as with all other autoimmune diseases, in my opinion, but especially the gut. I mean, how can you say that the food that you eat that passes through that organ does not affect that organ in any way, shape, or form? I mean, you have to sort of, you have to wonder if the person is really thinking that through. But of course it does. And there are studies that say that. Now, that's not what's taught in gastroenterology residencies, because that doesn't sell pills. And so, you know, there's no product at the end of that. So you don't have a multi-million dollar marketing firm budgeted out to push this out and let everyone know, hey, if you just get people, you know, not eating certain things, you get them on to a certain diet, no more Crohn's. You know, I mean, there's no money. You know, there's no money at the end of that. So no one's going to spend the money marketing and getting reps out to gastroenterologists say, ooh, use my product. Here's this thing. Just tell people to buy meat. I don't know if the Cattlemen's Association wants to get on that, but, you know, if someone has an interest in that, can figure out some way to monetize that, get in there, because, you know, this is a better treatment than steroids, and it's a hell of a lot less expensive than the biologic agents that they use as well, which are quite harmful in a number of different ways, and yes, can help people. It's sort of the lesser of two evils, but so you're not winning this situation. It's horribly expensive, has a lot of side effects, and you still have this issue, and you're only treating the symptoms. You're not actually counteracting the disease. Whereas when you adjust the diet, you are addressing the root cause mechanism. As can be seen, you remove certain things from the diet, disease goes away. That's a cause and effect relationship. So you address the root cause. Obviously, that's always going to be the best answer.
Yeah, that's great, Anthony. See, this is where I go with the common sense. Basically, I have clients that come to me with Crohn's. They go carnivore and they haven't got it anymore. Mm. You know, that's sort of proof. And normally they say, I've tried everything. I mean, that's a really common thing that they say. Literally, this is my last chance saloon or something like that. I've tried every sort of diet, and they try carnivore and they can't believe that, you know, they've got 50 odd or whatever, and they've had all these problems, all these gut, you know, issues. Crohn's in particular is one that always comes up. At least once a month, I get a client that's struggling with it, and they eat this way and it goes. And some of them are a little bit bitter that haven't been told about this way of eating. And, and the best ones, actually, are the ones that are skeptical. They come to it thinking, well, I'm going to do it. I don't think it's good for me. And they do it and they can't believe it. So they're sort of reluctant carnivores at first. They tend to come round to it. Rich, I can't bear you being quiet for so long, mate. So do you want to chime in a bit?
Nobody wants to listen to me chatting when Dr. Chafee's on board.
Right.
No, just to add really quickly, I mean, it makes perfect sense. We look for these magic pills, but as Anthony says, it's, you know, address the root cause and these issues go away. These issues are caused by an inflammatory basis and intestinal permeability. And this is what plants do. They cause this intestinal permeability and they cause lots of inflammation. Remove those two factors and everything else just clears up and goes away. Eat meat.
Excellent.
It's as simple as that.
So I'm going to put some of the comments up because, you know, they are pertinent to what we're talking about. Copper's Carnival Kitchen. Aussies, meet Dr. Chafee in person at Regenerate Health Summit. Mm-hmm. And that's in Melbourne on the 21st of April. So thanks for that. It's always good to plug these things so you can meet your heroes in person. Right. He's going to be in Austin as well. So, right. Dr. Chafee, you're all over the place. So we're going to move on to a question. Now, really? What are your top five favorite movies?
I don't know. I think it changes. For a very long time, number one was Ace Ventura. Ted replaced that. I don't think I've ever laughed harder at a movie in my entire life than when I watched Ted in the theaters. And I watched it three more times that week. I think I watched it the Monday it came out, then the Tuesday, then the Wednesday, and then the Friday again. And then I think I watched it only twice the next week. And then I went back and watched Flash Gordon, which is a terrible, terrible movie from 1980, because I'd only seen it as a kid. And so I was like watching that just to like augment my Ted watching experience to, you know, sort of be back in the mindset of that movie. And so those would definitely be up there. I tend to like comedies. It depends on what sort of pops up in my head. But you know, one of my favorite movies for a long time was things like Happy Gilmore as well. It always cracked me up. I always thought that was Adam Sandler's best movie. And I mean, there are actual really good movies that are not just goofy comedies that I really like. I'm just not really thinking about them. And oh my gosh, why can't I think of anything? Well, maybe I'll just put series after that, like the original Star Wars, the original three Indiana Jones. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just stop after that. Yeah, but I watched those hundreds of times as a kid, or dozens anyway. But I would like watch like the Star Wars all the way through, and then like start over the beginning and just do that. You know, you always had like the youngest kid in the house just basically controlled the TV, and you're just like, oh god, he's on there again. You know, so that was me for a time anyway. And then there was my little brother with Barney of all things. I did not know why the hell he did that, but yeah, never into that stupid dinosaur.
I know the dinosaur you mean. Right. Yeah. A proper question now. Could taking iodine or iodine, depending where you live, cause weight gain in a 65-year-old female?
It shouldn't. I caution people about iodine just because it can exacerbate Hashimoto's, and most people with thyroid dysfunction don't ever get that checked, and or don't even necessarily know they have thyroid dysfunction. So, you know, I just caution people that, you know, if you don't have iodine deficiency, you know, why are you taking iodine? You may, most people do, but you know, if they're on like a standard sort of diet, they certainly might anyway. Most people have a lot of vitamin and mineral deficiencies, but you may not. And so if you don't have one, then I don't think there's any point in taking it. If you are a bit low and you want to supplement it, I just, and especially if you're worried about your thyroid, it's like, oh, my thyroid is slightly underactive. Oh, it could be iodine. Well, it could be, but it could be something else as well. And so, you know, check if you have thyroid dysfunction, then you check yourself for Hashimoto's. It is way more common than people think. You know, people generally don't look for Hashimoto's until it's a disaster, until the TSH is above 10. And then they start investigating and saying, oh, okay, well, why the hell is that happening? And it's a bit, you know, the horse is out of the barn at that point. I mean, you missed your moment. And so, you know, the thyroid is severely damaged at that point and may not ever recover fully. And so, you know, obviously you want to, you know, you want to get on top of it before that. So I would check in my patient population well before we get to that mark. If your TSH is above 2, it can double your risk of developing thyroid cancer. So obviously that's not normal, even though it can go up to 4, 4.5, depending on the area, it can go possibly higher than that. But, you know, just above 2 is doubles your risk of thyroid cancer. So that's obviously not an acceptable range to keep your patients in. So I would check before that. And we actually find quite a lot of people with Hashimoto's. You know, it just hasn't just completely destroyed them. So no, I don't think it's going to raise, you know, make you gain weight. And you know, unless it's sort of a roundabout sort of way that you exacerbated Hashimoto's, rose up your antibodies, damaged your thyroid, you produced less thyroid hormone, and that depressed your metabolism. But taking iodine shouldn't directly cause weight gain, no.
No, I don't think so. Just had a couple of people message me. They're listening in headphones and they can hear, I think they can hear your hands on the mic, Anthony. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, right. Yeah, that's it. That's the noise. we have a lovely question here, which Richard will be able to answer as well. Greetings to all. What does it exactly mean, 24-hour live? What does that mean?
Richard. So that is our 24-hour... We are live for 24 hours. Spot on. We are live on YouTube for 24 hours. Last year, Stephen and I did the world's first ever 24-hour live carnivore-a-thon. It was a live that we discussed all things carnivore, all things healthy keto. We touch base on a little bit also. But it's a live in which we get fantastic guests come on each hour. Dr. Chafee kindly joined us for 3 hours, I think. 2 or 3 hours last year.
That was 2 hours. Yep. Well, last time was, I think, 3 hours.
Yeah.
And I was going to say this time, I thought it was 2 hours this time.
Two this time, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. All right, you scared me. I was like, I need to go to sleep. I was up until like 3:30 in the morning last night, and then up at 7 for work today. I was just like, oh, did I do that to myself again? Okay. All right.
And then yeah. We have you dragged on these shows at 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
But well,
no, really appreciate it. Yeah.
Oh, that's all good.
I mean, I stood for 24 hours like this. That's it. 24 hours. I mean, occasionally Richard had to talk while I nipped to have a pee, basically, but didn't eat, didn't drink, you know, which I don't think you could do when you're high carb. You could only do it when you're fat adapted, I think. But that's it. It's really that simple. 24-hour live stream. We start in UK, I think, at 9 a.m.
9 a.m.
on the 7th of the 7th. And the idea was that you could remember it because it's 24/7/7. 24 hours on the 7th of the 7th. Right, not 24/7, but 24/7/7. Right, don't miss that. We've got Dr. Anthony Chafee, of course, top of the bill, and then we've got the supporting people like Robert Kiltz, you know, and Dr. Simon Sort, Dr. Philip Avadia, and we've got Sean Baker, and tons of other great guests. So I'm only joking there. Anyway, going to a live joke from Anthony, you know, my favorite joke or corny joke is, who would you like to have as a guest at a dinner party? Alive or dead? And I'm like, well, someone alive. So, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely someone alive would be good.
Once a week, man, which is a great pun. While we all agree that diet, animal-based, of course, is very important in achieving good health, what role does Anthony Chafee think quantum biology plays? For example, blue light exposure.
Yeah. Well, I do think that that's important. I mean, we're trying to really cater to our own biology and our makeup. And we are terrestrial beings. We're not troglodytes. We didn't grow up in a cave or deep under the sea. We grew up in the sun and on the earth. And that's where our bodies are designed to be. Now, does that necessarily mean that we have to do that? No, but it does not surprise me that there is more and more evidence coming out that there is an effect that this has, and it could be extremely positive and beneficial. Our circadian rhythm is well and truly tied up with the cycles of light. And we're sort of getting this light pollution in our eyes and these blue lights and white lights and things like that in and around our house. And we're screwing that up. Our brains tell what time it is based on the frequency of light that's coming into through your eyes and into your brains. And so, you know, if you're messing with that, your brain doesn't know really what's going on. You may disrupt your hormones. You may bounce off your circadian rhythm. You may not get your testosterone in the morning. You may not get your cortisol or estrogen, or your melatonin at night, or your growth hormone, all these sorts of things. There's all these different hormones wrapped in tons and tons and tons of hormones, but they may not be as able to, you know, function properly and be released properly. So I do absolutely think that this is something that is very beneficial to our health, to try to be, you know, out in the sun in the morning, or to try to be outside, you know, whenever you can, you know, barefoot. I don't know much about these sorts of things apart from, you know, seeing these things peripherally and, you know, not seeing any reason why I would doubt it. I need to look more into it and speak to people like Dr. Chad Cruz and take a look at a lot of the studies that he talks about and others talk about. But, you know, it's fairly mainstream understanding about how light affects our circadian rhythm and our hormonal cycles. That's not fringe. You know, that's been out there for a very long time, and very mainstream scientists such as Andrew Huberman and others talk about this regularly. But I mean, this is something that's been around for decades. So I definitely think that plays a major role in our life. And I mean, I even just look at how I feel when I go camping for 2 weeks, few times I've ever done that. And I've just been, you know, up with the sun and then busy all day and then, you know, doing things outside. And then light goes down, sun goes down, fire goes on, hanging out. I'm just naturally like, oof, I just want to go to sleep. I'm not on my phone. I'm not on any screens. I don't have any artificial light besides the fire. And I go to sleep. I sleep like an absolute baby, like a well-behaved baby. And they don't all sleep. And then I wake up, you know, with the first crack of light. I get up and I feel great, you know. And when you get into that pattern, you do that for, you know, a couple of weeks, you just feel fantastic at the end of that. You know, you really feel recharged and refreshed. So I certainly like that. And it's something I want to look into more. But no, I absolutely think that that has a big role to play in our health.
Yeah, and I think the people that are skeptical when I talk about that sort of stuff, I say, have you ever worked in an office where you haven't had a window and then you've suddenly moved and it's just got a window? Does that make a difference? It's a real simple thing like that. Like, well, yeah, actually, my lounge is a bit dark, so I tend to be at the back of the house where there's French doors. I'm like, well, there you go. You are just believing that daylight is going to help you because it does. I mean, it seems obvious to me. If you've ever been in a dark room, I nearly said a dark sort of oppressive room because dark rooms are oppressive a lot of the time. So I think you're right to talk about all the science there, but sometimes just real world experience. And you talked about camping and all that, and people often sort of say, well, yeah, but that person's on holiday. I say, well, yeah, but also what I just said, you can be at work and feel better because you're near a window, or you've got a better view, or it's a sunny day and you can see the birds, or you know, there's so many good things about nature. Right, we've got somebody really thankful for your appearance here, Barry Simon.
Yeah.
Super chat for Dr. Chafee there. Thanks for all you do, Dr. Chafee. I'm doing carnivore, but I'm having an all-over body cramping issue. I take a good AMT of electrolytes amount, that is, along with trace elements, and drink almost a gallon of water per day. Could this be oxalate dumping or question mark?
Well, cramping potentially. Quite often, cramps are to do with, they could be element. They could be electrolytes such as magnesium, and most people will be, you know, low on magnesium, if not, you know, probably not outright deficient, but, you know, lower than they want to be. I don't know if it would be oxalate dumping, although oxalate dumping can sort of manifest as almost anything. It just sort of affect things in a lot of different ways, but generally cramps are dehydration in my experience. And certainly when you are, you know, starting out on this, you can get sort of fluid shifts. You sort of lose too much water and just require more water throughout your day. And so I tend to find that even when people are taking electrolytes, they're just not getting any improvement from that. Some do, but, you know, the vast majority of people that I hear about, you know, some people just take electrolytes and that does it and that's fine. But other times, you know, when you actually hear about it, when people have been taking electrolytes, have been trying these sorts of things, and I'm like, look, this is just not helping. Do I take more electrolytes? What do I do? And to me, it's like, you know, obviously it's not the electrolytes at that point. You're taking the electrolytes, you're covering that. It's almost always dehydration. It's almost always that they need more water. You know, I understand that you're drinking about a gallon a day. It just may not be enough for your needs at the moment. So I would just try to ramp that up and see if you can add that on. If you just feel like you're drowning, like I just really can't drink anymore, then fair enough. But do try to increase it from there and see how you go. It's probably going to be a short-term thing. You might not need this for a long time, but especially in summer months in places like Australia, and if people are active and they're outdoors, you're going to need more water. And if you're transitioning over to a carnivore diet, sometimes you can have a higher requirement for water early on. And so most often when people get these cramps, it's because of dehydration. In my experience, it can be other things. That's the most common cause.
And do you think that it's possible to drink too much water and cause dehydration because your body is expelling the excess water and therefore taking electrolytes out? So you get this vicious circle of over drinking?
Well, you can certainly cause hyponatremia. And so you can flush out too much sodium. And that's not safe, obviously. That's not good. If you're taking electrolytes, you're probably, you know, going to be okay. But yeah, you can definitely overconsume water and then cause a hyponatremia. So people do need to be careful of that. That affects your brain generally. It doesn't cause cramps. Low magnesium can cause cramps. I've never seen a patient in the hospital that had low sodium or low potassium clinically on blood reports. And we see them like, oh, shoot, you know, Mrs. Davis has a low, you know, potassium. They don't present with cramping, right? They, you know, they have other symptoms. If it gets low enough, you know, if it gets like, if your sodium goes below 130, you can get extremely confused. You can get cerebral edema and things like that. So it's like, it's actually quite unsafe. But they're very lethargic. They're very sleepy. It's hard to rouse them. Very confused and don't know what the hell is going on. And they're just sort of basically slipping into a coma. So that's pretty obvious, you know, when that happens. And the obvious part of it is not body cramps, you know. So when people say, oh, I need more salt, yeah, maybe you do, but I don't think it's just going to be causing all of those cramps. It's generally not drinking enough water.
Brilliant. We have
in the works, Steve. Can I throw a spanner in the works in regard to that one?
Yeah, please yeah. Do. I mean, there's three of us on the screen, and that's the point of us being here.
Cramping, in my experience, is usually a calcium issue. Excess calcium. Mm. Calcium excites the muscle. Calcium depletes magnesium. So we can combat this through two ways, either decreasing calcium or increasing the magnesium. The thing with excess calcium is that it also depletes sodium. A gallon seems like a lot to me, and I think it could be the opposite issue. I think you could be drinking too much water with maybe not the right ratio of electrolytes. It'd be interesting to find out, one, how much calcium you're consuming, i.e. if you live in a carnivore lifestyle and eating lots of eggs, you'd be surprised how much calcium there is in an egg. There's around 20 to 25 milligrams per egg of calcium. If we look as nature intended, a piece of beef and everything within nature comes with a set amount or set ratio of electrolytes. Potassium is really high, so potassium predominates, and it's about four times higher than sodium. Then it drops right down to magnesium, and below that again is calcium. And at best, calcium is at an even level with magnesium, and this is how the cell operates. It's a one-to-one ratio, roughly. If we increase the calcium too much with maybe cheese or raw milk or eggs, that can throw that ratio out, and again that calcium also depletes potassium, which can lead to further cramping issues. If you are using electrolytes and the ratio of sodium to potassium is wrong, then that can also lead to cramping, because most electrolytes predominate sodium, and then they drop right down with a low level of potassium, but the potassium needs to be almost level to the sodium, because excess sodium also depletes potassium. So you've got all of these contributing factors going on in there. So first of all, I'd look at the calcium, look at the electrolytes, make sure that the potassium is not... So the ratio that we see with most electrolytes on the market is, say, 1,000 milligrams of sodium, and then it'll drop right down to 200 milligrams of potassium. That 200 needs to be at least half. So it needs to be at least 500, if not higher. And the closer to a one-to-one ratio, the better. Once you address those two things, then maybe look at combating the water intake. And again, as Stephen says, drinking too much water can dehydrate, because you're flushing out the electrolytes, especially if that ratio is wrong in the first place. But calcium is usually the biggest contributing factor, as it's excitatory to the muscle. So again, combat that with either increasing magnesium or reducing the calcium.
Thanks, Reed.
So I hadn't actually heard that hypercalcemia caused cramping. Low calcemia certainly does. It causes tetany. And you test this, you sort of tap on the muscle and just through your face will cramp up and things like that. You sort of put like a tourniquet on your arm and sort of tap these muscles, and they'll just cramp up like hell. But you know, you can always check these sorts of things. You can always just sort of see where you're at, and you certainly don't need to take a whole bunch of calcium or anything like that. You know, some people think that they need to take a lot of supplements. You don't generally, or specifically calcium. You know, think that you need to eat a lot of calcium. because there's not a lot of calcium in meat. But it's like, okay, well, where does a lioness get calcium to make its milk? Right. They're eating from meat, right? And so they're getting, obviously there's calcium in meat, and your body, uses that and efficiently, as opposed to, you know, when you're eating a bunch of plants with anti-nutrients and oxalates and you're stripping all this calcium out, you need overabundance in order to overwhelm that and just get the little that you need. All mammals are weaning, they drink their mother's milk and then they wean onto the mother's diet and they eat that diet for the rest of their life. And that's when most of the long bones are growing. So that's when most of this growth is happening. So the most calcium demand happens after they're weaned, after they're off milk. And again, where the hell is the mother getting that calcium to give to the baby in the first place if the mother's diet is deficient and the child is going to be weaned onto the mother's diet? And that's when most of this, the bones are going to grow and most of the calcium is going to be deposited. So you get onto these sorts of diets, you certainly don't need to take a lot of calcium supplements unless you have an actual deficiency. Like, I just don't think people need to supplement as much as some do, unless they have a deficiency. Now, there's a lot of people that do have deficiencies. There are a lot of people that come in and they've just been on different diets, just a standard diet or a plant-based diet, and they're going to be deficient. They're going to be very deficient. Carnivore diet is going to catch you up, especially if you include some more high-dense parts of the animal, like the organs. That's supplements for carnivores is organ. But if you're extremely deficient and, it's sort of at a dangerously low level, go ahead and supplement. But if you're not, then I don't think that's a good idea, especially if you're in normal ranges. There's no point in supplementing if you're in a normal range. And, as people know from listening to me, the normal range isn't all that normal. From the reference range. The reference range is an average for the community that every single lab has a different one. So they have, when they're changing the reference range, updating the reference ranges, first 2,000 people that come in, that is the reference range. And so that's going to be different at every single lab. And as we get sicker and fatter and more malnourished, those ranges just change and they get worse and worse and worse. So I say, oh, look, you're normal. And, but you're comparing yourself to sick, malnourished people. So in actual good ranges, if you're actually in those actual good ranges, then you definitely don't need the supplement.
Yeah, especially with calcium. I'm not a big fan of calcium supplementation, either supplementation or excess in the diet, because studies have shown excessive amounts of 700 milligrams per day can increase risk of cardiovascular disease by as much as 15%. I eat eggs, but I'm well below the 500. And I think if we eat as nature intended, then, these issues tend to go away, don't they? But not a big fan of calcium supplementation. If we look at how nature intended, the only two things in nature that contain high calcium, as Dr. Chafee alluded to there, is eggs, which give birth to an animal, and milk, mother's breast milk. That's the only, and we're not meant to drink milk past the age of infancy, let alone from another animal. So it, these contributing factors, I think, can massively impact. And our absorption of calcium our need for it is massively reduced as we get older because of vitamin D and K2 and sodium and protein. All of these things build bone and send the calcium into the bone. In fact, calcium absorption to the bone is directly correlated with salt, which a lot of people don't realize. So we need salt to send calcium to the bone. So a deficiency of salt could cause a problem even.
Brilliant. And I'm going to plug my book, which talks about normal ranges in the context of keto and carnivore there. So just in case you didn't see that, Guide to Blood Tests. Anyway, right. And I talk about all that sort of stuff. We've got a great question here, which is... by the way, this is not medical advice. It's all for information and educational purposes. What would be causing me to get nasty bruising veins in my right leg being carnivore over a year? I don't lift anything heavy.
It may not have anything to do with a carnivore diet. I can't really think of anything that would do that. I mean, generally bruising is caused well, it is caused by damage to the blood vessels and the capillaries, and you bleed out and you bleed in sort of under the skin. So I don't know if you're on any medication that may increase your risk of bleeding or something like that, but it really shouldn't happen unless you're sort of bumping it on something or something's damaging it or some sort of trauma. Even some people have very friable tissue and very thin tissue, and it can bruise very easily, especially if they're on medications like blood thinners or aspirin, which a lot of people are on. But usually don't show up unless you've at least had something touch it, push it, hit it. So it's always happening on the right leg. I would wonder what's going on with that right leg. I can't think of anything to do with a carnivore diet. Maybe Stephen or Richard may have some thoughts, but you know, if you continue to have this on and on and on, might be worth going to your doctor and just having them take a look at it and just see what's going on, because it's not, you know, it's a bit odd that you would just have continued bruising in that same leg if you're not having something hit it or bump it.
Yeah.
I jumped last week. Yeah, of course, Rich.
No, go on. You go on.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, go to the doctor. Exactly what Anthony Chafee said there, and just get your clotting factors looked at.
Yeah.
But go on, Rich.
I'd question which side of the of your body you sleep on. That might be a factor. Do you sit with your legs crossed? Is it one? Is it the left over the right, for example? Have you lost so much weight that now you can see things that weren't there prior? And are you eating all the gristly things on your meat? Are you getting all of the collagen? Are you eating the gristle on the bone and the fatty cuts of the stringy bits on the beef? All of these are really important for building and forming collagen within the body. A couple of things to take away there. But it is a strange one, isn't it? Especially if it's only on one side.
Yeah. Yeah, let's move on. I think that's pretty much covered. We have the next question here, which is, I have moya moya. What will carnivore do for me?
Well, that's a good question. So that's a complicated pathology, but basically what that has to do is with the vessels in the brain can be very friable, and so they can get a lot of bleeds, and that can cause strokes. And so sometimes we do bypass surgery to revascularize or you know, bypass certain areas that are damaged of people with moya moya. I don't know of any studies with ketogenic diets with moya moya. So I can't tell you. I can't tell you what's going to happen with that. It's a very rare disease, and I just don't know. Many people who have, I don't think I know anybody who's tried a carnivore diet with moya moya, maybe one that I spoke to a while ago, but I don't know how they're doing with that. It's one of those things that, you know, we don't have a lot of data on everything. And this is certainly one that we don't, or that I don't know about. I don't know if anyone else knows about ketogenic diets with moya moya. I don't know if you guys even have come across moya moya. It's super rare, but it's going to improve your life in a lot of ways anyway. Is it going to improve your moya moya? We don't know. There are things like Crohn's disease where you remove the food is really causing your body to overreact and build and make antibodies and attack your body. So that's a cause and effect relationship, and I can tell you what that's going to do when you go on a carnivore diet. It's going to go away. But with moya moya, I can't say that same thing. I don't know what the underlying cause is for moya moya, so I don't know how a carnivore diet is going to affect that. What I would imagine is, you know, this is sort of a you know, an inflammatory sort of condition, and this can cause friability of the vessels. This is going to improve your collagen. This is going to improve your inflammation. This is going to improve a lot of different things that could contribute to that. But I have absolutely no idea. The best thing to do is just try it, see what happens with it. You're going to feel 1,000 times better anyway. You're going to fix a lot of different sorts of things. You know, none of us here have had moya moya, and yet we're still doing carnivore because we feel so much better, and our bodies work so much better, and our brains work so much better. And so even though we didn't necessarily reverse something serious like moya moya, it's still worth it to us. So I think it will still be worth it to you to do that, and very well may help with that. However, it would just be sort of a wait and see sort of thing. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think if anything is, just to clarify for people, it's the obstruction of the arteries at the base of the brain, and the cause is unknown. You see, so it's very difficult to answer anything where the cause is unknown, because if you don't know the cause, how can you fix it? But I think what you're saying, Dr. Chafee, is if you deal with your systemic inflammation, you're giving your body the best environment possible to make that condition less troublesome. If you've got an obstruction in the artery, it's there. So if you're then inflamed and your arteries are inflamed around that area, then that blockage is going to be even more restricted, isn't it? Then the blood flow to the brain is going to be restricted. So you may find going carnivore, because you reduce inflammation, you start to feel better. I mean, I'm a great believer in sort of common sense. It's not going to kill you. It's not going to make it worse. So I think, just trying it and then coming back actually in 6-7 weeks and saying, yeah, did. I mean, we would like to have a case study, wouldn't we? We would like to have someone who has had that and it has improved, because that's how you start to learn about these things. I mean, I think everybody on the screen admits we probably know like 1% of what we'd like to know about the body. So, I've not come across it. 15 years of rehab, but 5 years of doing carnivore coaching. Never had a client with it. So I think I can't see it doing anything other than improving the situation. Did you want to say anything, Rich?
No, I think you guys have covered that.
Okay. Jacqueline's next, and she's a newbie. 10 weeks into carnivore. Well done. And I have low blood pressure and feel shaky and no energy. Do I need more salt? I take electrolytes, but maybe not enough.
Look, 10 weeks is a while to have electrolyte issues, but if you have low blood pressures and feeling shaky, then that can absolutely be from low sodium, low electrolytes, and that can drop your blood pressure. So if you're feeling that, well, you've already checked your blood pressure, so you know you have low blood pressure. So eat more salt and drink more water, and especially when people, sometimes it's more subtle. So sometimes, when you get up, you stand up, you have a sort of a head rush, you feel a bit sort of woozy, and then that recovers. What happens to everybody, even in normal conditions. But if that's happening to you regularly, that could be because you're getting this postural drop in blood pressure that's maintaining, and you're not able to overcome that normally. And so if you have those sorts of things, you should think, am I getting enough salt? Am I getting enough water? Those sorts of things.
Yeah, I agree. And the water, I think, was a big contributing factor there, because that does help with blood pressure. But sodium is the key. So possibly too much potassium. Potassium calms the heart. So we want to increase the sodium. And I would question, if you are still feeling dizzy, are you eating enough, Jacqueline? Are you consuming enough food? Maybe you're not eating enough fat and protein. So a couple of things to look at there potentially.
Yeah, and Jacqueline, I think, is actually a member of our school community. So you can always come to our live question and answers and get to more in-depth one. But obviously, we're making the most of having Dr. Anthony Chafee with us today. So anyway, I hope those answers helped you. Scott is asking, I think Richard might jump in with this one as well. What do you think about MCT oil and its daily use? But Dr. Chafee first, as you're the guest.
Well, I just tend to avoid it. I don't use it myself. I just try to get animal fats. There may be advantages to MCT oils, but I just like getting the natural fats from meat in what I'm eating. I tend to steer clear of some of the plant oils in any case, just because of they come along with plant sterols. If they're out of the plant and they're unsaturated, are they stable, or are they oxidized, and all these other sorts of things. I just try to eat meat and fat in its whole form. That's my usual go-to.
Yeah, Richard? As always, I completely agree. I think we should get as many compounds from animal proteins as we can. I am a big lover of MCT, particularly C8. C8 is the 6% of the coconut oil. Again, it does come from plants, but when it's at 99.9%, all of the other nasties within that compound have been removed. But there are benefits. MCT is not the healthiest fat, and people believe that it is because of its microbial benefits. It's, in fact, it's the most antimicrobial substance available without a doctor's prescription. But it isn't the healthiest. Animal fats are the healthiest for us. But where MCT comes into a league of its own is its ability to convert into ketones incredibly quickly. Ketones, the production of BHB. So when we consume the C8, for example, it's sent straight to the liver through the hepatic portal vein, and it's almost instantly converted into beta-hydroxybutyrate. And it will do this whether you are living a ketogenic, carnivore, or even a carb lifestyle. It will instantly convert. And therefore, the benefits of the BHB will follow, i.e. the blocking of NLRP3 inflammasome, so lowering inflammation, increased in insulin sensitivity. The ketones will breach the blood-brain barrier and fuel the brain with energy. It will increase mechanical efficiency of the heart by as much as 35% and blood flow by as much as 70%. So it does have its benefits. Again, it does come from a plant, but it's a tool for me. It doesn't make a part of my diet, but I do find it beneficial, especially for things like public speaking events where, you know, you may be feeling a little bit tired and you need that energy to the brain. You don't want to drink the coffee because of the acrylamide. I mean, no, Dr. Chafee is not a fan of coffee at all, as it causes massive neuroinflammation with him, especially in the legs, if I can remember correctly. But MCT, that could confer a benefit in that instance, for example, because it's going to supply that our instant energy. But it's a tool. It's the same as everything else, isn't it? Electrolytes are a tool. All of these things are tools. Do you need them to be fit and healthy? No. If you eat nothing but meat, you are going to be considerably fit and healthier than any other point in your life. But all of these things are tools that may confer a benefit as and when you like to use them, you know?
Yeah, and it's a brilliant massage oil.
It's very good. I always did wonder, and that, thank you for clarifying that. I was a bit nervous with MCT oils. Does it come with the plant sterols? Does it come with all the other crap that you don't want? So it does sound like there is some available that you can get pretty pure.
So if you are visiting, obviously, which we know you are, in May, the PHC, I'll bring some with me for you to try, because I produce it. So I mean, and that I haven't just ranted that off because it's a sales pitch. You know, as you know, I produce certain products to help people along their journey. But I do these things because I believe that there is a benefit to using them. And there is so much rubbish on the market, especially with electrolytes, that this is why I produce what I believe to be the world's purest form of electrolytes. And that's something else I'd like to get you to try, because we're producing a carnivore version, which is all natural ingredients, and there's going to be no artificials. And it also contains a compound called astaxanthin, which is the world's only true antioxidant. And again, we can chat about that. It's something that comes from salmon. But we've produced one for the carnivore community specifically that doesn't contain any stevia. The only downside is the vast majority of the market that are gravitated into a low-carb, ketogenic, carnivore lifestyle don't want to drink salt water, whereas us three would gladly do so. Many people are one step too far. But it's all about these incremental changes. And MCT and electrolytes are, you know, or they do make up at least part of those incremental changes and allow people to maintain the journey. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's about sustaining the journey, maintaining the journey. If we can't sustain or maintain, then everything falls apart.
Brilliant. Sorry to be like the teacher here, but I'm moving it along. We have 547 people and about 200 questions. So I know we won't get through them all. And if you've put a question on there, I thank you very much. If you've done it recently, we are trying to get through them as quick as possible, but we want to give you a proper answer to every question as well. So Carsten is asking, autoimmune caused by lectins, how strong is the scientific data?
Well, Richard might have a lot to say on this, but, you know, it's actually, something that we do see. We see these lectins getting into the body and interacting with our body and interacting with our cells. We see it in our gut. wheat germ and gluten is that's binding onto the surface of antigens on our cells and in the gut, and that can cause damage, leaky gut, and then these little suckers can get in there. So that's been demonstrated. You know, we have demonstrated that these can get in the body. We can see lectins tracking up the vagus nerve into the brain. We can see them that they're binding onto the different carbohydrates and antigens on different cell structures in the body. And then we all of a sudden have this specific immune response with antibodies that are specific. So if they're just sort of attacking something, but now they're attacking something specific, we can look for Hashimoto's antibodies. We can test for these sorts of things, right? So that means there's some sort of specific complex on the likely on the thyroid that the body is attacking. And then you stop eating these things and antibodies go away. So, you know, in certainly from a clinical standpoint, you see this, again, a cause and effect relationship. You remove these sorts of things, the antibodies just go down and they go away. And you can measure them both in patient symptoms and also in the actual blood form. You can look for these specific antibodies. They go away. So I have patients, I estimate over 100 patients with Hashimoto's and a lot of other autoimmune issues, but Hashimoto's being definitely the most prevalent in my patient population. And certainly if you have one autoimmune issue, you'd likely have others. So, you know, we just, they will also likely have other autoimmune issues as well, but at least that many with Hashimoto's. And we measure these things. And so, you know, we change their diet, put them on a carnivore diet, especially like a red meat and water diet. And just look, their antibodies are in the thousands and then they're in the hundreds and then they're in the tens and then they're gone. They're not registering. They're just undetectable, and that's what we see. We see this in real time. So it's it's certainly enough evidence for me to do this for my patients. And then, regardless of if it's lectins or if it's something else, either way, when you remove plants, it goes away. And so that's the main thing. You know, do we have as hard of evidence as we want to? You know, maybe not, but it's enough for me to say, well, look, this is something that, you know, looks like it's a credible mechanism. And when we do it in practice, it works. And so that's really all it comes down to. I mean, that's the end of the day. What I'm worried about is what is going to help my patient and what is going to get them better and what's going to get their antibodies down and get their thyroid functioning again. And so removal of all plants, including lectins, could be other things that they're reacting to too. Certainly even things like dairy, you know, that trips off autoimmunity as well. So there's likely other things that are going on as well. But either way, if you remove these things, the problem goes away. And that's what I think is the most important part of this.
Excellent. Bishop's Deep Learning. Thank you for the super chat. For Richard and Anthony, what is the best way to gain muscle on the carnivore diet? Workout frequency, fat to protein ratio. Thanks.
So I'll just jump in very quickly, and just my general guide is just, you know, you work out hard, you get onto an appropriate lifting schedule, you consistently you maintain that lifting schedule, and you eat enough. So as far as frequency, fat to protein ratios, you're still eating the same thing. You're still eating, you know, a high fat, it's also a high protein diet, and you keep eating until fatty meat stops tasting good. You try to do that a couple times a day, at least, to make sure your body's getting enough. And that's certainly for, you know, just the layman or, you know, the athlete that's not trying to just perfectly sculpt their body, like so a rugby player, a sprinter, or something like that. That's what worked for me. And Richard is definitely the expert on this, on how to actually really make a program here. So I'd be interested to see what he says.
Yeah, look, don't overthink it. I think Anthony's hit the nail on the head. Protein, always consume protein with fat. Every cell in the body is made of protein and fat, and we need the fat with the protein. If you're looking to aim for any numbers, aim for 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, and that is a rough estimate. We need at least 0.5 grams per pound and 0.82 per pound in order to build muscle. So 1 gram per pound is a nice, easy number to remember. If you want to really get into the weeds, concentrate on eccentric movements. train for no longer than an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, four sets ranging from reps of 12 to 16, and again on eccentric movements. If you are looking to benefit from the mTOR activation, train in the morning, ideally fasted. This is one mTOR activation. It takes 3.5 to 4 hours for mTOR to reset. So again, eat maybe 3.5 to 4 hours after that, 3.5 to 4 hours after that, and so on. And that way you can still put in a 12-hour fast if you wish to do fasting. And this way you're activating mTOR four times, which is optimal for building muscle. You don't have to do that every day, but that is maximal. And a lot of research I'm doing recently in regards to building muscle and increasing bone strength and tendon strength, it may be more beneficial to, in fact, train twice in one day around 8 hours apart and having the second day off. More to come on that. I'm still researching. I'm looking into this in regards to my building my strength up in my legs, because as you guys know, I've recently started doing running and cycling, so I complete 180 from bodybuilding. But there's a couple of tips there to jump on. So there should be plenty to get you started.
Brilliant.
So I was just going to say, can I ask a question? So when you're saying workout twice a day, you're working the same muscle group twice a day, 8 hours apart?
Yeah. So one of the studies I've been looking at is, I can't remember the lady's name, but she is the world record holder for something like 500 odd miles in the shortest time and 100 mile. She's a scientist who's looked into muscle adaptation and bone and tendon adaptation in regards to training frequency. So rather than training every day, which is what a lot of athletes do, she's looked into training twice in one day, doing the same training, split. So the same. So if you were to train for 1 hour each day, for example, train half an hour in the morning, half an hour sort of 6 to 8 hours apart, and then have the second day off. And this seems to be building most adaptations. The science that I was looking into it yesterday, as sad as it sounds, this is what I was doing yesterday afternoon when everyone else is watching TV and Netflix and so on. I was looking at these research papers. It's incredible stuff. And it also showed that the glycogen, muscle glycogen, was higher when trained low carb. So this was with athletes who were consuming carb, but they would deplete glycogen, and then they would refeed with carbohydrate. But it showed that the adaptations created in doing so increased their ability to store more muscle glycogen, which goes against everything that we are told from, you know, the general standpoint of training and glycogen storage. But yeah, it's probably a whole other podcast on that when we look into the evidence, but it's incredible research.
Yeah, and I'm going to plug my ultra conditioning program, because I've been doing alternate day training for 15 years. And I think Anthony doesn't know this, but I used to be an advanced personal trainer, and I actually got somebody to the Olympics javelin throwing.
Nice.
So
that's badass.
I can answer some of these questions, but I'd love to hear Richard. You know, and I think it's not sad, mate, looking at research studies. That's what I do all the time.
Okay, you're not a loser. It's all right. It's okay.
Yes. We love you, mate. We love you. Right.
I was going to ask you. Can I ask one more thing? Just in that same vein, I just saw you know, one of those old school bodybuilders. It was like that. Was that someone with an M? Something like that. It's like Mike M something. Anyway,
months.
Almost certainly, yeah. And you know, he was one of those big ass dudes. He's in the sort of the Arnold era, and he was saying that actually, what you wanted to do, you wanted to just work out once. And he was saying like one set to failure, that's all you needed to do. And then rest 72 hours before you do your next workout session. And so you're not even the same muscle group, but just the next set of muscle groups. You want to give your body 72 hours to rest entirely. And you want to do that. And if you did two sets of something, then that was, yes, you'd get more for it, but you'd hurt yourself on your recovery and all that stuff. I don't know if he was doing carnivore or something like that. A lot of them were doing steak and eggs back then and lots of steroids. But so I don't know what the combination here is that there's going to be a winner. But just wonder what your thoughts are on that. Because I certainly, in my own experience, I've always had better results in my strength and physique and my performance If I work my muscle groups out twice a week, that's what I found worked best for me. And that's why I set up my workout routine around that. So I would do the same muscle group twice a week. And that's what I felt worked best. But it's always interesting to hear people's thoughts.
Yeah, I think we build when we recover. We're not building muscle when we are training. So recovery is incredibly important. What I found was nothing worked for me on a 7-day week. So rather than training twice a week, I would train twice every 8 days. So things seem to work on an 8-day cycle. So I would never have set days for training, but I would alternate muscle groups, and the reason for that is giving that rest in between. So you know, you'd hit chest on a Monday, for example, and then you know I wouldn't train that till 4 days later. Legs sometimes took a little bit longer, but again, that healing period is really important. I can imagine why resting for 72 hours would work, because you're causing a lot of damage. But then the issue with going too heavy also is that when you're lifting too heavy, it does cause more damage. This is why I moved away from the heavy weights, always to failure, but eccentric movements were really important for me, because that time and attention was lasting longer. And we're actually stronger on eccentric movements rather than concentric. So that not only allowed me to build muscle as in physique-wise, but it helped build a lot of strength. And a lot of people don't know this, but when I was when I came away from the bodybuilding, I'm 20K lighter now. So I'm absolutely tiny compared to what I was when I was bodybuilding. But when I came away from that, I was... with what I could lift, I would have been in the top 10 in the UK in powerlifting. And that is between everyone, which is the clean and dirty feds, i.e. supplemented mm-hmm. with anabolics and not. And obviously I don't take anabolics. So I was in the top 10 or would have been in the top 10. And that's what I was going to gravitate into. But I got pulled into the world of running and cycling and training for duathlons and triathlons. So a complete 180 from bodybuilding. But I do feel a lot fitter and healthier for doing so. And something you mentioned recently, Anthony, is that, you know, you and I don't train an awful lot yet. I'm, you know, in a vest, I'm still big for a runner. I've still got the delts and the lats. I'm small, but I'm still holding the muscle without even training. And my brother mentioned to me recently that I still look fairly shapely for someone that doesn't lift any weights and hasn't lifted a weight in a year and a half. And that just adds weight to the fact that living the carnivore lifestyle, muscle's precious. The body doesn't want to waste it. And we do retain. And I believe it's more to do with volume in the muscle than actually muscle size itself. Because when I've tested, even though I've lost 20K, my dry protein has only come down by 2K. So my dry, yes, I've lost muscle because I'm not using it, but that 2K in a year and a half throughout my whole body doesn't sound like an awful lot. And when we put that fluid back into the muscle, i.e. through stimulation training, I believe that I could get back to a physique that I was once in incredibly quickly. Maybe a test for a future to see how quickly we can do that. But muscle's precious, isn't it? So we don't lose it as much as people think.
Yeah, I think your days off are underestimated, because they're not days off, they're recovery days.
Recovery days.
Physiological response, a training response to what you've done is really important. And it's a big hot topic at the moment in Premier League soccer, because there's teams playing, you know, every 3 days, and we're seeing lots and lots of injuries. So even, you know, prime athletes and prime sports people need those recovery days. Sorry to get to this one so long after you've posted, but thank you very much for the super chat. Someone I know was diagnosed with glioblastoma stage 4 about 9 months ago. Would a standard carnivore diet be fine to try, or should it be modified because of cancer? I have seen some of your videos with survivors.
Well, no, it doesn't need to be modified in you know, really in any significant way. You know, the only modification you need to make is in respect to the GKI, so the glucose ketone index. I think that's your sort of your hallmark here. So normally I don't think that you need to fast for any periods of time, you know, apart from just what your body's telling you to do on a carnivore diet. There's two schools of thoughts in the ketogenic metabolic therapy approach to cancer with carnivore diet. You need to keep your GKI down. There are a lot of studies in animals and humans that showed that restricting eating, so not eating as much as your body's necessarily demanding, and having your blood sugar lower and your ketones higher, and you see that ratio, is it called GKI, glucose ketone index, you keep that under 2, that's a therapeutic range, keep that under 1, that's even better, that has shown to be very beneficial for cancer outcomes and survival and prolonging survival, at least in the studies that we have so far in GBM, which are limited. Now, there's a lot of studies in a lot of different cancers, but specifically GBM, it's a bit limited. There are smaller trials, anywhere from 15 to 30 people. There is a randomized control trial with about 20 patients, and they have shown efficacy and benefit, certainly being safe, and in some of these things showing benefit, people living, you know, far past where they would have otherwise, and actually showing recession and receding GBM, you know, even on like fourth line treatment, where they go through the surgery, chemo, radiation, it recurs, and they have the surgery, some more chemo, last bit of radiation, now it's not safe, and they have a recurrence, they have a re-resection, a re-resection, and they can't really, they're sort of capped out on radiation, and then they have to go through different sorts of end stage chemo, such as Avastin, which is really hard on the body, makes the brain very friable. It's it for surgeries after that. You can't operate on a patient's brain after they've been on Avastin because the tissue just falls apart. They just bleed and they just bleed and bleed and bleed, and you can't stop it. So that's sort of a last line approach. And then the people that have Avastin and they're not being helped, and they say, well, you know, you could just stop eating carbs. And then they do that. So Cedars-Sinai does that in America right now, and they published a large case series with about 15 patients. Most of them were brain tumors. Not all of them were GBMs, but they showed that the brain tumors and the GBMs even responded extremely well, even though this was like a fourth line defense against the GBM. In that case series, they survived for years and years past where they were dying, they were on their way out, and then they went on a ketogenic metabolic therapy, and all of a sudden they just kept going, and on MRI tumors were shrinking. And there's multiple case series with 15, 16 patients from there's another case series published out of Phoenix, showed the same thing. It showed these big tumors and they're just shrinking down. So you do a ketogenic carnivore diet and you get your GKI down below 2 for much of the time, below 1 if you can. You do that with a combination of ketogenic carnivore diet and fasting if you need it. If you need to have periods of fasting, you go for it to bring that GKI down. And then you have to refeed on other days because you don't want to lose too much weight. You can't let it, make it so you're too weak to defend yourself and to maintain your body. After about 8 to GBM in particular is a bit nasty because cancers run on glucose and glutamine, and GBMs run on about 75% glutamine. And so they do much better if you get onto an agent that disrupts glutamine. There are chemotherapy agents. One's called Don, D-O-N. I don't have the chemical name in mind at the moment, but that's been used in animal models with GBM. When you put people on a ketogenic diet and Don, they all the mice survive. And that was with the work of Professor Thomas Seyfried out of Boston College. And they showed that on imaging and then on on histology, when they sacrificed the rats, that the tumors had just died. They just gone away and just died. The cells had just died because you'd taken away their energy sources and they just shut down and died. So that may or may not be something that your doctor can help you with. That may or may not be something you can get your hands on because of, depending on how your doctor and your oncologist feels about those sorts of agents. But there are chemotherapy agents that do that. Like Don. Don is a chemotherapy agent, but it's not necessarily licensed for GBM, so it would be off label, and you don't know if your oncologist would be okay with that. when you fast between 8 and 14 days, you make glutamine, first of all. You also make glucose, but you're just keeping it down at lower levels. And because these cancer cells have such a high metabolic demand and they're inefficient at making energy, they really require a lot of this stuff. And if they don't have a sufficient amount, the cells die off. And so that's what you want to do. You sort of want to starve these suckers out. Glutamine is in meat. It's also in plant proteins. You're not going to avoid it by, you know, going vegan or anything like that. Glutamine is denatured by cooking. So if you're really that worried about it, you can cook your meat, or you can limit your meat, and you can have periods of fasting. And that will get rid of incoming glucose and incoming glutamine. And then you want to, if you need to fast to get your GKI down, that can be a helpful adjunct. There are people that you know, find success in this. And according to Dr. Seyfried, when you get to about sort of 8 to 14 day fasting range, this actually can disrupt your own glutamine metabolism. And so that can actually have favorable results for a longer fast. Now, you have to do that carefully. You should do that under medical supervision. You should be careful about refeeding and how you start eating again after you do a long fast like that, or else you can hurt yourself. But those are some things that people are currently trialing and using in their own cases, or in their patient populations, for different people that are treating this sort of thing. And then the other side of it is the paleomedicina side, and they've been treating cancers and GBMs for 15 years with this, with a PKD diet, the Paleolithic ketogenic diet, which is what cavemen were eating during the ice ages, which is meat. That's it, right? So there was absolutely nothing besides fatty meat, but you limit the amount that you're eating. And so you have to use organs. So you eat organs because they're more nutrient dense. You're not getting in as much food, so you need more nutrient dense food. And so you're limiting the amount that you're eating. All the studies show in animals and humans that restricted, you know, calorie restricted, I hate that word, but calorie restricted eating, calorie restricted ketogenic diets are the most beneficial to survival and longevity and improved outcomes. So that's what they do. So they don't do fasting. They don't want you to do fasting, but they definitely do restrict. So you're restricting what you're taking in. You're eating more high density food and nutrition, and you're very, very dialed in with that. So those are sorts of things. Those are some caveats. But really, what you do the exact same thing. You eat very high fat, and I mean like 2 grams of fat to 1 gram of protein, and you really get your ketones up. And you try to keep your GKI down below 2 and below 1 as much as possible on average for the week. You know, so you have different days you might be fasting. You may need to fast. You may need to limit what you eat and to get your GKI down. But that's what I would do. And I would adjust what you're eating. I would still eat the same thing, fatty meat and some organs, but I would do it in such a way that you can keep your GKI down most of the time. And if you have to limit what you're eating or fast for periods of time and you're losing more weight than you should, you're going to have refeed days, and you're going to have to, you know, feed the body and make sure you're getting enough nutrition for your body so you can support yourself in this fight. And then you have these periods of refeed days, and then you go back to it. All right. Your body can do that. You know, we're more than capable and adapted to deal with famines and lean times, and so your body can do that. You just be very careful with it. Make sure you're not losing too much weight so that it affects your health negatively, and you have these refeed days, but you have these stretches and these periods where you are significantly limiting the amount of available energy for these cancer cells. And if you can hit it with something like Dawn or some of these other agents that disrupt glutamine, that you can look into, there's a lot of you know, literature on that. And that's something that is, you know, is in keeping, you know, safe for you to do with your current plan. You know, obviously you need to talk to your doctor about these sorts of things. You know, then you do that. That's Thomas Seyfried's idea of a press pulse modality. So you have a constant pressure of a low GKI ketogenic diet. And every now and then you hit it with like Schrumbers, with like, you're just going to fast for a week and you're going to hit it with Dawn and you're going to do these sorts of things where you really aggressively go at it. So it's constant pressure of just energy, constant energy deprivation for these cancer cells. And then every now and then you hit it with these periods of fasting and the glutamine disruptors. And then the other, fly in the ointment there is deuterium, which is, this seems to be a very interesting line of research that's now growing. But there's a guy named Dr. Gabor Somlai, who's actually published multiple papers on this and how having lower amounts of deuterium in the body, which is heavy hydrogen, it's this hydrogen with an extra neutron on it or with a neutron added onto it, that this actually can be very damaging to the mitochondria, damaging to the cells. And if you have lower levels of deuterium, this can actually disrupt and damage cancer cells more and can actually help in that treatment also, which is how he came to ketogenic carnivore sort of diets, because that's the diet that naturally lowers your deuterium more than anything else. So I have a couple interviews with him on my channel, and I have another interview with Dr. Laszlo Borosz on the subject. And he's, he was a professor of medicine at UCLA and ran a biochemistry lab there and did a lot of research on deuterium. And he actually didn't believe it. He just thought it was crazy. And Gabor found him. They're both from Hungary originally. Like, hey, why don't you do this research? And he's like, oh my God, this is crazy. And he's just like, all right, well, look, it's $25,000 a cell line if you want to do something like that. And they're like, yeah, let's do three. And he's like, oh, okay, these guys are serious. So he ran the tests and he went, holy shit, these guys are onto something. Like, this is actually real. And so now he just went full on headlong into the research. And now he teaches that. He teaches deuteronomics, which is a deuterium-based biochemistry, and how this affects diseases. So that's another thing you can sort of look into, probably too long of a topic to get into here. But if you look up those interviews with Laszlo Borosz and Gabor Somlai on my channel, I just did a more recent one. It has more new published data showing the benefits of this. So something to think about. If I had something like GBM or a family member did, I would just throw the kitchen sink at it. And I would just be extremely aggressive with this stuff because GBMs don't mess around. They are likely one of the most aggressive cancers that exists, certainly the most aggressive primary brain tumor. And so it's not something you want to play around with. I would be exquisitely strict if I had something like this, and I would just be borderline neurotic about my numbers and making sure that everything was just exactly the way I wanted it. At least at first, until you got into a pattern, you figured out how you could, how you could live with this sort of thing. And even down the road, if you're seeing like, hey, there's nothing here, my MRIs are all clean, it could spark back up. You have to take this very seriously. This is a lifelong issue. And so even while there are long-term survivors, 9-10 years plus that have been doing this, and there's others that I've been talking to, people I've been talking to, they're like, oh yeah, there's this random guy who's been 23 years doing ketogenic diet with the GBM, which no one knows who the hell he is. He's just off living his life, And so I'm still trying to track that guy down. But when you start slipping off of this can come back. A friend of mine, Pablo Kelly, is one of these long-term survivors with GBM, and he had a bit of a relapse because he started saying, well, I should be able to have ice cream with my kids. I should be able to eat this, and I should be able to do that. And all of a sudden he started having more symptoms, and I went in and got checked out, and oh shit, this thing's growing again. And so he just realized, no, I can't think like that. That's stupid. I should be able to. Should doesn't come into it. I can't. And so if I want to be here for my kids and my wife, I can't. And so he's now back on the straight and narrow. So that's what you have to think of too, is that this GBM isn't necessarily something that's going to go away and stay away. It's something that if it goes away, you have to keep it away by doing this. So this is a lifetime commitment. This is a lifestyle. This is just how you live your life now. It's no different than any three of us here and how we're living our life as well. It's just you need to be just very switched on. And, you know, there's less room for error. You know, you can't have these cheat days. Oh, well, whatever. I mean, you can, but it's going to be detrimental. And so, yeah, you know, that's what I would do. I would just be very, very dialed in and strict with it.
Yeah, and I think that's analogous to when people talk about type 2 diabetes, for instance, and we talk about reversing it. And I get in online arguments where they say, we've not cured it. I'm saying, no, you've reversed the symptoms. If they go back to their old way of eating, then you're opening the door back to those symptoms. So it's sort of very similar to that, obviously more dramatic. Brilliant answer there. I think it's diazoxynorleucine, yeah, if people want to look it up. And I think it's 6 at the beginning and 5 in the middle of that. So anyway.
I did call it in the comments a little earlier.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, okay. It is in the comments. Yeah.
Laurel, thank you very much for $9.99.
I'll post that again.
I don't know where that super chat's gone to, but thank you very much. Very generous super chat. I think this is to Dr. Anthony Chafee, $400, everything. Is meat of the young calf, not veal, nutritionally okay to have as a mature beef meat? The meat of the calf, not nutritionally okay.
Yeah, well, so like in Australia, you know, it's like they it's basically just the next step past veal. It'd be like yearlings. You know, so like in America, it's usually like 18 months to 24 months. They would slaughter the steers. But in Australia, they do a lot of yearlings, which really bugs me because they're like smaller steaks. I'm like, where the hell's my big ass ribeye? Like, and, you know, it's just smaller. So I think it's very similar. But, you know, it's something that I would like to do some tests with, or talk to some ranchers about doing some tests. The thing is that I think when you have an animal out just eating grass, it's sort of building up, you know, nutrient density, and you can taste that in the meat. I've had different aged meat and it just tastes more beefy. There's more beef flavor. Those flavors are the nutrients. And then you have these sort of very bland sort of things. You're like, am I really getting anything out of this? So, you know, you have these regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cows, and it's just like there's much more flavor to it. There's much more of this nice, rich sort of – there's actually an aroma that's very different on grass-fed meat and especially older ones. And you know, the taste is different. It's just – it's much more potent. It's not gamey, but it's just more beef flavor, if that makes sense. And we can see in regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cows, in any case, that at least some of the ranchers that I've spoken to, that they've sent their meat off and got it tested, and it's like 4 or 5 times the number of micronutrients. So, you know, it does objectively have more nutrients in there, and I think that probably is reflected in the taste from similar aged cows. Now, I've had older cows that have grass-fed their entire life. I would imagine that they have more nutrient density because they have 10 times the beef flavor of even these other younger regeneratively raised grass-fed and finished cows. They aren't commercially viable at the moment. Probably that's good for all of us who know about this, because they are way better and you generally get them for cheaper, and you don't have to fight for them. But they're freaking delicious. And so if you can go to a rancher and just say, hey, I want your oldest cow that's only ever eaten grass, generally they just grind them up for hamburger because people think, oh, they're too tough. I think you're sacrificing flavor for texture, and the texture is not all that different. It's actually excellent. The gristle is harder. Some of this, like, get some of these tendons, they're like whale bone. It's just like, oh my god. But they're easy just to pluck out and just toss them. You're not chewing on them, and you know, it's like meat gum for 2 hours. You know, you just chuck it, you get rid of it. And so I would imagine that those are more nutrient dense the older that you get, if it's eating a better diet. However, I don't know anyone who sent that off, because I don't know people that have an older herd that are selling that to a bespoke market, and they're sending us off saying, oh, look at this, we have 10 times, 20 times the amount of nutrients. I think if you're eating younger meat, it's not going to be as nutrient dense. It's still going to be fantastic. It's still going to be absolutely, hands down better than the other options available, certainly the other plant-based options available. And so if that's what you have available, you know, that's what you have that's available to you, I think that's fine. But I would expect that if we were to test older cows, that you'd get more nutrient density out of it. Yes.
Great. This is a really nice question from Tom. Dr. Chafee, could you clarify what you mean by carnivore being a fasting mimicking diet? In my opinion, after you eat a kilo of meat, you're definitely not in a fasting state.
No, I 100% agree with you. And it's not a fasting mimicking diet. A fasting mimics a carnivore diet. Fasting mimics your our primary metabolic state, the metabolic state that we are in when we eat our main source of nutrition, which is meat. It hasn't always been meat since the dawn of humanity. When you eat a kilo of meat, you are definitely not fasting. And so that's the thing. This was misnamed a fasting metabolism and a fed metabolism. And that goes back decades. And I think the only reason we did that was because by the time we were able to look at our biochemistry at a molecular level, everyone was eating carbohydrates. They said, oh, when you eat, it looks like this. And when you don't eat, it looks completely different. Failing to recognize that if you eat anything else except carbohydrates, it also looks like you aren't eating at all. Speaking to my niece, who's now, pre-med in America, and she's taking biochemistry this year, or maybe she's even, she's taking it this year. She was saying they don't even call it fed state and fasting state anymore. It's a carbohydrate metabolism and a non-carbohydrate metabolism, which is much more accurate. The fed state and fasting state, that's a value judgment. Just saying that, like, oh, this is the only thing worth eating over here. It is just a carbohydrate metabolism versus a non-carbohydrate metabolism. And I think that the non-carbohydrate metabolism is our primary metabolic state, and that fasting mimics it. I think that a lot of the benefit you get from fasting largely comes from just not eating the wrong thing and from being in the correct metabolic state. This is something with insulin. Insulin has, over 100 different mechanisms in the body. One of them is to suppress and decrease autophagy, and the turnover of the organelles and the cells that are older and damaged. So when people talk about, you have to fast for 5 days every now and then and all that sort of stuff to get the autophagy, you only have to get 72 hours, 84 hours, 116 hours, all this sort of stuff. No, you just need to stop eating carbohydrates. You need your insulin down. That happens all the time. So at the moment, I believe that Stephen, Richard, and myself have been on the equivalent of 6,482 day fast, because we just our insulin has been low this whole time. Obviously not that long, but a long ass time. It's certainly longer than 72 hours. So, the autophagy has been long accounted for in our systems. So it's really just comes down to being the correct metabolic state. 70% of all animal species are carnivores. They're all eating protein and fat. They're all in this so-called ketogenic starvation state, right? And animals that eat fiber break down that fiber into saturated fat and protein. So they're not getting carbohydrates either. They're in the non-carbohydrate driven metabolism also. So this isn't a shock to your system. This is, I don't care what Ray Pete tells you in your nightmares. Like, it's not the case that this is a shock to the system or stress to the system. This is the normal metabolic state of human beings and nearly every animal on earth. And so the idea that this is stressing us and freaking us out and this is bad makes absolutely no sense biologically and is wrong. Anyway, people can look at Richard and my video on the subject. Is ketosis harmful? Short answer, no. And we go through just hours of data and literature on that, and to really sort of hammer that point home.
Brilliant. Anthony, thank you so much for your time. Richard just private messaged me and I didn't realize we'd shot over an hour by quite a considerable distance, because I've been trying to sort of moderate with him. But
I said 2 hours is fine.
Oh, you're right for 2 hours.
That's right.
Really good.
Oh, fantastic. There we are. If I'll keep my trap shut then. I was just
No, it's all good.
Yeah, I thought it was 2 hours, but then Richard's on the wall,
Yeah,
that's good.
Can I just jump in? If we're staying on, can I just jump in to add to that as well also that Yeah, I agree completely with what Anthony's just said. It's just by being in a ketogenic state, which is what we are in, this is our metabolic state, even when we live in a carnivore lifestyle, the benefits that we see of fasting, which are autophagy, mitophagy, brown fat activation, lipolysis, and insulin sensitivity, they're all exhibited through living the lifestyle, regardless of whether we are in a state of AMPK or mTOR activation. We are benefited. It's like a seesaw effect. One predominates, but both are always playing that fact. But it those benefits are there regardless of being fasted or not. And this is why just living the lifestyle has that benefit. And we don't need to force fasting. And I would also argue that maybe potentially extended fasting doesn't benefit a lot of women. The more that I'm working with, I seem to see that them being in more of I don't want to use the term fed state after Anthony's just said that, but maybe eating 2 to 3 meals a day may help a little bit better in regards to, but some people do thrive, but it does cause hormonal issues with some. And what I would argue is that if we look at our evolutionary period, the men of the tribe would be out hunting for hours and days while the females were there prepping food and maybe eating before the hunters returned, and therefore their state of prolonged fasting was going to be a lot lower than that of the men. And this seems to be a big problem within the female community that I work with, that they're pushing for this extended fast, and it leads to lethargy, skin conditions, hair loss. And it's to do with not eating enough. And we're told by many of the influencers within the community that it's because of lack of carbohydrate to create thyroid hormone, but it's not to do with carbohydrates, it's to do with not eating enough, and that comes down to animal proteins and fat. We need animal proteins and we need fat especially for the production of hormones. So don't neglect your nutrition. Eat when you're hungry. You know, if you're not hungry, don't eat, but be mindful that we do need that protein, we do need that fat, and the benefits are there regardless of fasting or not.
Yeah, I'm still struggling to see what part of carbohydrates helps make thyroid hormone. But anyway, we're getting that. So here's a nice question. My blood pressure went down significantly going from coffee to decaf coffee. Any benefits to quitting the decaffeinated worthy of quitting?
Well, I mean, that's interesting. Your blood pressure went down. I wonder what type of decaf you switched to. You know, there are things called rancid oils in coffee that when you heat it over 160 degrees, they come out and are known to kick off hypertension. And so generally filtered coffee will actually take that out. So things like espressos or like the Bodum press coffee, those sorts of French press coffees, they won't filter that out. You sort of see this oily sort of sheen on the surface. And those can definitely jack up your blood pressure. And this is what cold brew coffee was for. It was supposed to be the heart-healthy blood pressure coffee back in the 60s and 70s and things like that. And sort of had a resurgence with Starbucks and things like that more recently. But I would wonder what you're switching to. You know, caffeine can certainly affect that, but it's generally the things that affect your blood pressure the most are those rancid oils. So I wonder if you went to this sort of decaf, it's now filtered as opposed to more espresso sort of things from coffee shop. I don't know, but as to benefits from dropping decaf, absolutely. So caffeine is just one of 150,000 or so chemicals that are in coffee. And there's all sorts of these different nasty chemicals that are not good for you. When you taste something bitter, your brain is warning you about something, saying, hey, why don't you not eat this? You know, when you're just out there just putting things in your mouth and you're like, oh, that tastes good, I'll eat it. That tastes bitter. No, I'm not going to eat it. That's the natural instinct in nature. Until you have someone telling you, no, that bitter taste is good. Ooh, that's good. Yes, you want it to taste horrible. You want to hate your life. You know, like, well, that doesn't make sense. You know, but we convince ourselves of this. So if you have that bitter taste, your brain's telling you there's something there that you don't want. So coffee is very bitter. And, you know, it's a bean. A bean is a seed. A seed is a plant's baby. That's where you generally find the highest concentration of toxins is in the seeds, which because the plant's trying to protect that the most because that's the next generation. So, yes, I think there's absolutely a lot of benefit to dropping decaf. In fact, I generally would rather see people like switch to caffeine pills and skip the whole decaf side of the coffee. The caffeine, although it's a neurotoxin developed as an insecticide to fry the brains of insects that are trying to eat that plant, I still think that getting rid of those 150,000 other things probably even more beneficial than just getting rid of the caffeine. If you can take a caffeine pill in the morning, and that can give you the bump that you want, then you can sort of do that and then wean yourself off that and come off. Eventually you'll have better energy anyway, but you'll have less, you know, soreness and aches and muscle pains and joint pains and other sorts of problems. But you're already off the caffeine, so don't worry about that. Don't start the caffeine pill now because you're already off the caffeine. I would just drop it completely and just switch over to water. I think you'll feel a lot better overall and have a lot less inflammation in your body.
Great. Okay, we've got Lucy here, who's been carnivore for 7 months, but she's having gut issues. Blood tests are all clear. Tried lion diet, but end up at the toilet within 2 to 3 hours of eating. Any suggestions for helping my gut microbiome?
Well, the thing is that it could be your microbiome, but you have to always consider all the other things. You know, are you strict lion diet, or strict meat and water? Do you still have any sort of artificial sweeteners? Do you have even electrolytes that have stevia or erythritol, things like that? Are you having coffee? Are you having tea? Do you take magnesium supplements? Do you take metformin or other sorts of diabetes medications? These can all cause loose stools, or at least, you know, have mild laxative effects, and now you don't have a bunch of fiber in your body. They can move things through more quickly. And then obviously, if you're eating, your body has a limited capacity to absorb fat. And so if you're eating far past your body's capacity to absorb fat, it's going to go out. It has to come out just one way, in one direction. So that is something that can cause loose stools as well. So, you know, especially we're talking about the timing of your meals there. You're eating a lion diet, you're just eating meat, and then you're like, oh, nope, this has to go. That could suggest that maybe you're ingesting something that's speeding this along. If you're having anything else, if you're not, let's assume you're not, that's about the time you'd see that this is sort of coming through your system and digestion, and the fat that didn't get digested and absorbed is now coming out and causing problems. It's not necessarily a problem. It's not necessarily that you're sick or there's an issue. It's just inconvenient. And so that could be an issue as well. So just maybe look at that and see if you can adjust your fat and if that changes anything. If you can, if you're very, very constipated and you get overflow diarrhea where you're half blocked up and you can get liquid stools pushing around the harder stools and get liquid diarrhea pretty much all the time. And then every now and then you get like this boulder that comes out. This sounds more like the other side, that you're having more fat and you eat that fat and your body just can't absorb it all. So it just goes out. Especially people without a gallbladder may run into that as well, because they're just not going to be able to absorb as much fat in one go. So maybe play with that. If you've tried these sorts of things, you've eliminated out everything else, you've played around with the fat levels, and you do still think this is a microbiome issue, 7 months carnivore, though, it's most people's microbiomes are radically different at that point. But all things, if you excluded everything else and you're thinking maybe this is a microbiome issue, fermented yogurt. So fermented dairy, you get that live culture yogurt, small amounts, no carbs if you can. Some of them have a little bit, but try to get like the lowest carbs that you can. Put that on a piece of meat, chew it up together, swallow it together whole. You can work those bacteria sort of into the bolus of food, and that will hopefully get it past your stomach acid, and so it doesn't get burnt up and gets it off down into your colon. And you just do that for a week or two, but that should reseed your bacteria, and then just the food that you're eating will support the bacteria. But, you know, if you think it's a microbiome issue, you can always send off for a microbiome test. 7 months on a carnivore diet, most people actually have pretty stellar microbiomes at that point. So I would, from what you're telling me there, it sounds more like excess fat to me, but maybe you guys have a thought on that.
Rich?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think minced beef can cause an issue. Again, it's the fat issue. It's got to be predominantly a fat problem, especially with that sort of movement time. The quality of meat, I would question whether you're consuming aged meats, because aged meats, obviously, by definition, become rancid. So eat your meat fresh. You know, if you do buy in bulk, freeze it as soon as you can and try to eat it, you know, as you're taking it out of the freezer. But fresh is always best. But mincemeat, I've noticed, has caused a number of issues with clients of mine. I'm a big fan of mincemeat. It's incredibly cheap, incredibly nutrient dense. I love pan frying it, and I'll pour the fat over, and I think it's incredible. Sometimes I'll fry an egg and chuck that on top as well. But it does cause issues with some people. So I think Anthony's hit the nail on the head. I think it's predominantly a fat issue.
Yeah.
Cool.
And
I
was just going to say too, and that rendered fat seems to go through people quicker.
Yeah.
You know, so then when you're doing like ground beef, just like Richard said, a lot of that will render out, and that can be, it just goes through you quicker, more quickly. If you have like the solid fat tissue and you chew it up, obviously, but then your body has to sort of work on these things with your acids and digestive enzymes. It takes longer to extract that fat. It gives your body a chance to respond with lipase and bile to get out there and actually break the stuff down and absorb it. So it's more conducive to adequate digestion and absorption. And so what some people find, even when they're lowering down the amount of fat and they're still having issues with it, or they're still eating a very reasonable amount or low amount of fat and none of these other issues that we touched on, that when they start eating solid fat as opposed to rendered fat, or they even, the most extreme I've seen people have to do is they cut off the fat before cooking and eat it uncooked and then cook the rest of the meat separately. And that seemed to have worked for a number of people. One thing that I've seen as a growing trend is that people think that they have to just take on so much salt that they actually dump a ton of salt and rock salt in their water. So it's just, I mean, they're just drinking like, you know, water from the Dead Sea or something like that. And it's just like, just a ton of salt. That is an osmotic, that will work as an osmotic laxative. That will pull out water from your body and just flush your bowels. So if you want to do a bowel flush, that's how you do it. I don't recommend it, but that was one thing. I was talking to I spoke to multiple people, but you're talking about, okay, what are you eating? What are you doing? This and this. And it sounded like the only thing they were doing was meat and water. And then it was just sort of at the end, I was like, oh, well, I'm also putting in a buttload of salt into my water. And it's just like, okay, well, that can absolutely do it. So just try to think of all these things as well. And, but those are some points that can help.
And what fats are you cooking in also? I don't cook in any fat anymore. I just use the fat from the meat that I cook in. But I know within our community, you know, we're heavily biased towards adding butter, tallow, lard, or ghee. But you don't need to add any fat when cooking. So possibly another lever to pull there, take the fat when cooking out if you are using so.
Cool. That's great. Just for those that are wondering why I'm not answering many questions, is because later on, if you want to ask questions of myself or Richard, we have our live in 5 hours' time, 7 p.m. in the UK. We do another hour and a half, an hour on YouTube, and then 30 minutes on another platform, which rhymes with Apple Crumble. So, yes, you can check us out there. Lucy from England. By the way, Rich is from Wales, you know, so I'm in England. He's in Wales. That's the United Kingdom anyway. And if you're from England and you're looking for beef jerky, I have found this, which is really good, from the guy that does the Mason Survivor Protocol. Because we always get all these Americans with all these fantastic things, and us in the UK, we've lagged behind. Oh, sorry.
Australia too.
Yeah.
I was saying Australia too. Yeah.
Crazy, isn't it? By the way, we're going to grow the carnival movement away from America and everywhere else. So, hello from England. I have a question. If we cannot take in too much fat due to our bodies only taking what we need, how does PSMF, which is protein-sparing modified fasting, work so well for people? Just curious, are struggling with weight?
Oh, look, you can starve yourself in a smaller dress size. Everybody knows that, but it doesn't mean that it's the most beneficial thing for your body. It doesn't mean it's the healthiest thing. It doesn't mean it's the thing that is going to be conducive to a healthy, strong metabolism. There's the Minnesota starvation trials that were done in World War II. They show that you put people on just basically, concentration camp rations, and yeah, you'll lose weight to a point, and then it'll level off and it'll plateau, and then that slows down and just sort of is able to maintain. It's on extremely low intake. That's your metabolism. Your metabolism is slowing down, and so that's not necessarily what you want. If it was just calories in, calories out, then some of these people would have ceased to exist, because they would have lost. They would have had to have lost more weight than they started with. So the modified protein sparing fasting. So that's just basically eating like a keto carnivore diet, but just super high protein and like next to no fat. And the idea there is that, well, you have fat available, your body can use that. I don't tend to agree with that. Our body is making bile for a reason. I don't think your body does that by mistake. I don't think it's just an accident. Your body is spending a lot of energy and resources to make bile, to absorb fat that it doesn't even want. I just don't think that makes sense at first principles and fundamental physiological basis. Bile is expensive. It's an expensive resource, and it costs a lot for our body to make it. So, it doesn't just do that for no reason. And since it's a limited resource, I think our body is very specific. Hey, we need this amount, right? Your body knows that it has fat there, and it's saying, hey, we want more. Fat isn't just a calorie source. Fat is a set and grouping of essential nutrients. There are essential fatty acids you have to have, or you can get very sick, or you can die. There are essential fat soluble nutrients you have to have, or you can get sick and you can die. So this is not something that you can just say, it's fine. Do you have all the fat soluble vitamins in your adipose tissue? Do you have all the omega-3s and DHA and EPA just stored there? Probably not. You have excess energy stored there. It's not necessarily in the form of the essential fatty acids and fat soluble vitamins that you actually require. So I don't really buy into that. If people want to do that and they feel that that's helpful to them, then they can. But I think that you run the risk of actually lowering your metabolism, and just you go into these yo-yo diets where you drop your metabolism and you lose weight for a while, and then it sort of plateaus off and you sort of feel miserable and you're not really having, enjoying this. You say, okay, well, I'm going to go back to what I was doing before, or maybe eating more fat. And then you balloon up and you put on weight. Oh my God. And then you're really scared of eating any other way because you put on weight. Well, of course you're putting on weight because you're telling your body you're in a famine and that you don't have enough nutrients and you're not able to get what your body requires. And so your metabolism has to slow down. And as it slows down, it stays down. And then when you start eating more, you put on weight because your body's saying, no, we need to store this now. The studies with the Biggest Loser show where they it's just the same thing. Don't eat anything. Just eat a stick of celery a week and then just work your ass off. And they destroyed they lost weight, but they destroyed their metabolisms. And they tested them 6 years later. Their metabolism had never recovered. So, that's not great, right? So that's not what you want to do. You want to encourage your metabolism. You want to encourage your body and say, hey, look, we're not in a famine. We whatever you tell me, I'm giving it to you, right? If you're eating carbs, you're eating lectins, you're eating other sorts of things that interfere with insulin, leptin, and ghrelin, you're going to overeat. If you're eating just meat, that doesn't happen. And so your body will tell you how much it wants. You don't have to micromanage it. You don't have to guess. Your body will do it for you. You just take in what your body is asking you for. And I think that includes fat. The other concern, and it's a real concern, is that of getting, if you're just on a carnivore diet or, a heavily animal-based ketogenic diet, and it's very low fat or no fat, where your macro is coming from is coming from protein only. And when you're only deriving energy from protein, that can actually be dangerous. And so you get what's called, you look it up, it's called, like rabbit starvation and protein poisoning. And it's not good. It's not good for you. You do need to get your energy from other sources besides protein as well. And obviously if you're not eating plants and carbs, you're getting that from fat. You could do it from carb, but I wouldn't. I would get it from the fat. Also, if you're trying to lose weight, why are you not eating fat? You know, we say, well, it's very calorie dense. Oh, you already have fat. Okay. What are you putting in your mouth? You're putting in things and you put it on a scale, it has weight. So you're eating things, right? So if you're going to get the same amount of calories, why wouldn't you eat the calories, the 2000 calories that weigh less, right? What do I mean by that? Fat has 9 calories per gram. And so we think, oh my God, there's all those calories and you could store those as fat. Oh, don't eat fat, right? And then there's 1 gram per, you know, 4 calories per 1 gram of carbs and amino acids. However, when you're using protein as energy, it actually drops down to about 3.4 calories per gram. So in real terms, if you're talking about taking in calories from meat and you're just eating the protein side of things and you're not eating the fat side of things, you will have to take in more grams of meat, of protein, in order to get the same amount of calories. So you have to take in more weight. You will be weighing more, right? And, you know, and calories in, calories out are a really bad model anyway, because most of the protein gets used as building blocks in any case. And carbohydrates affect a lot of hormones. And then there's a lot of fatty acids that used as building blocks as well. Not all of it's used as energy. But in any case, if you flip that equation around, the calories don't weigh anything. It doesn't matter what the calories are. If you have a glass of ice water, you have a glass of steaming hot water, the steaming hot water has a lot more calories than the ice water. They weigh the same effing thing, right? It's not, the calories don't weigh anything. It's heat energy. Grams weigh something. That's the only part of that equation that weighs anything, is the grams. And so you flip that equation around and now you're seeing 1 gram of fat per 9 calories. But you're seeing 3 grams of protein per 9 calories. So you have to eat 3 times as much protein in order to get 2,000 calories, if that's what your body requires that day, right? So why would you do that? You're putting on 3 times the amount of weight. So you can starve yourself and you can do all the other sorts of things, but I think that they're not the best way you can do it. I don't think that it's has your long-term health intentions best in check. If you just eat the way you're designed to eat and your body's telling you how to do that, you're going to lose weight. This is not a race. You know, you're not on a game show. You're not trying to, you know, it's not the Biggest Loser. You're not trying to lose weight faster than everybody else. You're trying to be as healthy as you possibly can. And part of that is going to be returning to a healthy body fat percentage. It will happen. But the thing is that you need to be healthy first. That's the primary motivation and objective. And all of this is being as healthy as you possibly can. And then the weight and musculature and all these other things, they're all secondary. They do come, right? But they are of secondary importance. I think you do this the right way. You do this in as healthy a way as possible, first and foremost, you don't have to rush. It will happen. Haste makes waste. The slow and steady wins the race, all these sorts of things. These sayings have been around for thousands of years for a reason. You know, do it the right way and you will get to where you want to go faster and in better shape. And in better form than if you try to do these other sorts of shortcuts.
Yeah, and there's a phrase called leave them wanting more. So Dr. Anthony Chafee, we've come to the end and we're going to leave them wanting more. Well, I always go out on high. I thought that was great. Richard, what did you think? Did you think that was rather good?
You're muted, buddy.
Nobody wants to listen to me chat anyway. No, fantastic. Well appreciated. Always super informative and always a pleasure. So I'm super looking forward to the PHC conference in May and also to our 24-hour live.
Yeah, definitely.
Exciting.
Awesome, guys. Well, it was great to see you both. And always a pleasure. Good to see you guys. Sorry, remind me, when's the 24-hour live again?
7th of the 7th.
Do I have that somewhere?
Yeah, and I think in the UK, you're here in midday, about the same time you started this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So obviously, okay. my clever ploy of 24/7/7 didn't work. I thought, how could we forget that? But anyway, that was good. And if there's any English people watching from your channel, Anthony, Richard is doing a talk at the Easter weekend at the War on Health. So if you want to come along and see Richard talk, because he says nobody wants to hear him, but they do. They do, because he's got lots to say. So that's the Easter weekend, and there's a link in the description if you want to come and hear Richard's talk. And there's some old fart talking about Bloods as well there on the same day. So, yeah, if you want to see that, then book into the War on Health. It's going to be a two-day conference. So, yeah, thanks, Anthony, for your time.
No problem. Thank you, guys. It's great to see you.
Yeah, you too, man.
And thanks, everyone, for joining.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Your support means the absolute world to me. And if you're enjoying the show, I've got a small favour to ask you. I'd be incredibly grateful if you would consider becoming a supporter and make a small monthly donation. Your contribution will really help to improve the show. I'll be able to improve the software, maybe put a few more episodes out, and do many things that I'm hoping to do in the future. Do them a lot quicker. So, it's a small monthly contribution. You can cancel at any time, and the link is in the show notes. Thanks very much for listening.